In the news.
I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
Yeah, we got our week one segment here. And, you know, we use the In the News segment to comment on what's going on in the world or stuff that, you know, kind of strikes our fancy that is consistent or parallel to the stuff you guys are encountering as you do the readings and some of the lecture modules. So week one, we're talking about, you know, starting up a country, talking about the United States Constitution and some of the core concepts that underlie the Constitution, like federalism and separation of powers and that kind of thing. So I've got three topics. Professor McDaniel and I have settled on three topics for today. We want to talk a little bit about the national anthem and kneeling in the NFL, sort of under the rubric of civil liberties and civil rights. We want to talk about a Supreme Court decision that came out recently about the states and gambling laws. But I want to lead off with something I encountered in a podcast. I'm not big on podcasts, but there are a couple of them that that actually I like quite a bit. One of them is Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History. And the season three initial podcast for Revisionist History talked about something that Professor McDaniel and I are actually really kind of interested in, and that is the Constitution and interpretation of the Constitution in a particular context. And the context that Gladwell kind of alluded to or served as the focus of his season three kickoff to Revisionist History involved Texas. All right, and I want to talk, if we can, there's a particular article in the Constitution, particular section from an article in the Constitution. And I have the quote. I wanted to put this quote up here because this kind of sets the table for the brief conversation we want to have today. So you guys can take a look at it, and I'll go ahead and read it to you. This is from Article 4, and it's Section 3 of Article 4. So Article 1 is about the Congress, Article 2 is about the presidency, Article 3 is about the Supreme Court. Article 4 talks about a lot of different things in American government. It's much less well known. So here's Section 3. The quote from the Constitution: new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, semicolon, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, semicolon, this will be important later, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states, comma, or parts of states, comma, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. All right, now, why would we care about this particular, you know, article in the Constitution, this section from Article 4? Well, a couple of things. The focus of the podcast, Revisionist History, was two states, one, West Virginia, and the second, Texas. Now, the West Virginia part should be pretty self-evident, right? The quote that you guys saw there says, and let me make sure I'm getting it right, no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state. Well, West Virginia, as you guys probably know, was in fact formed immediately after Virginia seceded during the Civil War, or precursor to the Civil War. So one question that has come up from time to time in American history is West Virginia in fact constitutional? Right? It seems in fact that it probably isn't. If you read the text, right, again, no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, right? Pretty clear. However, if you read the rest of that particular passage, you do notice that a little further along, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. Okay, so the Gladwell podcast focuses on semicolons. And how do you interpret semicolons? And what I want to draw your attention to here is the semicolon in this particular section of the Constitution. Now, why do we care about the semicolon? Well, here's the deal. If you read the semicolon as like a period, that is a full stop, you would get the following. No new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, period. Right? That's pretty clear. But it's not a period. It's a semicolon, and the next clause says, you know, basically, you can't form a state with a junction of two or more states without the consent of the legislatures of the states as well as of the Congress. Well, people who have looked at West Virginia have said, now, wait a sec, it gives you an out here. It basically says, well, you can do that so long as you have the consent of the state legislature and the Congress. right? That would be interpreting the clause or the semicolon more like a comma, right? That it says, well, you can't do that unless you get consent of the state legislature or the Congress. Now, in the case of West Virginia, when Virginia seceded, there were a number of counties in the northwest part of Virginia that said, hey, we're not interested in going along with this. We want to remain part of the Union. They had a state legislature, and the state legislature met and said, you know, we essentially want to be an independent state. The Congress, which of course was dealing with Virginia seceding, said that was okay. So in fact, you had the consent required so long as you read that particular clause as being relevant. That is, you know, if you get the consent of the state legislature and the Congress, relevant to the subject matter in the first part, like the pre-semicolon part, right? It says, yeah, you can break up a state and form new states so long as you get the consent of the state legislature. Now, I always thought this is interesting in what in the Gladwell podcast, they talked about, you know, how do you interpret the semicolon? And one of the things, they went to a woman who is an editor at The Atlantic. And she said that, in fact, you probably should interpret it more like a comma than a semicolon, because immediately after the semicolon, you have the word nor. And so he says, you can't do this, nor can you do that, unless you get the consent. And you wouldn't have the nor if it was only referent to the second part of that clause. Right, so now I'm sorry to go all grammatical on you here, but this is the kind of stuff that the Supreme Court pays a lot of attention to. And in fact, the constitutionality of West Virginia does in fact hinge on how you interpret that semicolon. Now, the Supreme Court has weighed in on this and said, in fact, that it's okay, that West Virginia was, you know, within its rights to set up a separate state. So the question has functionally been decided. I mean, I suppose you can always reopen these things. All right, now, but how does this relate to Texas? Okay, when Texas was admitted to the Union, it was admitted as part of, you know, congressional authorization. And let's go to the quote. There's a particular quote in the admission of Texas to the Union that I think is really relevant here as well. Okay, now, bear with me a second. It's kind of a long element to this. So this is from the Joint Resolution for Annexing Texas to the United States. It's approved in 1845. All right. New states of convenient size, not exceeding 4 in number, in addition to said state of Texas, and having sufficient population, may hereafter, by the consent of said state, be formed out of the territory thereof, which shall be entitled to admission under the provisions of the federal constitution. And then it goes on to talk about, you know, slave states versus free states within the state of Texas. So you guys have all probably heard people talk about Texas having the right to secede from the Union. I'm not talking about that. Forget that. That's another question, and that's actually been adjudicated on as well. And the short version is Texas does not have the right to secede. But this is a more interesting question. You know, so West Virginia formed its own state out of Virginia. Texas actually has congressional authorization on the books to form new states from within the jurisdiction of Texas. So what do we think about the proposition of Texas saying, you know, we have 2 senators right now, but we would like 10. We could break into 5 separate states and have 10 senators. There's already, as you guys recall from that provision in the Constitution, it says to do that, you need authorization of the state legislature and the Congress. The Congress has already granted that authority to the state of Texas in the terms under the Joint Resolution admitting Texas, and they have never gone back on that. So, you know, the point of this revisionist history podcast was to say that Texas has been way too conservative, small c conservative, in thinking about how to enhance its power. Texas could, quite constitutionally, break up into 5 states and enormously magnify its power, at least in the United States Senate. Interesting idea, right? So I want to do a little exercise for you here. Let's go ahead and get that map up of the state of Texas, right, on our tablet. All right, so we have authorization here from the Congress to create 5 states. Now it says has to have sufficient population, so, right, so they got to be, you know, fairly reasonable with respect to equity in terms of the size across these 5 jurisdictions. But Professor McDaniel and I are going to do this for you. We've been thinking about this a little bit. If we're going to carve up Texas into 5 states, right, so it said the 4, you know, the initial state of Texas and 4 additional states, how do we do this? All right, I'm going first. I'm taking the first move here since I got the pen. I am going to take this area up here, right? I'm going to create the state of Houston, right? So I'm taking the first shot here. The state of Houston, our flag is going to have the Astro symbol. All right, so that's our first state. Professor McDaniel, what do you want? What are you claiming here?
Really, for the state of Houston, I would have gone with basically the flag should have been cotton and sweat. a cotton oil rig and sweat.
Yeah, the old oil derrick, like the Oilers.
Yeah.
All right, what's our second state here?
So, of course, we have the state of Dallas.
All right, so we're going Dallas.
And their state flag would be of a tornado and a trap house.
Okay. All right, so we got Dallas. Dallas-Fort Worth, for those of you from the Metroplex area, all right? The state of Cowboya. All right, I'm going to take Central Texas. I'm going to exclude San Antonio, so I'm going to leave Bear. But I'm going to take Central Texas here. So I'm going to take Waco, and since I'm an Austinian, this will be the state of Austin.
All right, and their state flag would be a breakfast taco and a knit cap.
All right, so we've got three states now, Dallas, Houston, and Austin. What's your fourth state here?
Clearly, we're rather the state of San Antonio. I think San Antonio.
Okay. You want to run it all the way around the border?
Yeah, it'd probably run all the way down. Yeah. And
you want to give El Paso to West Texas, or you want to give that to this border?
Give El Paso to West Texas. I think El Paso is.
So we'll cut it here.
Clearly in its own world.
You got a name?
Right now, I'm going to call it Popovich Land.
Okay, so we'll go Popovich.
Yeah.
Popovichia?
Yeah, Popovichia, yes. I think that's much better.
All right. And on the Spurs. Okay, so that's our fourth state. And then I will close it out by taking West Texas. All right, so we got West Texas. Need a cool name for that. I don't know. We call it Friday Night Lights.
Yes.
FNL.
At first I was thinking Nowheresville, but
No. There we go. So we got our five states carved out of Texas as per authorized by Congress's joint resolution admitting Texas to the Union, right? So they're roughly, I think the West Texas state here, Friday Night Lights, is a little underpopulated compared to the others, but you could easily do this. Now, if we played this out, here's kind of the interesting thing. I think Republicans initially, conservatives would probably look at this and say, yeah, this is pretty great, right? We can get, instead of having two Republican senators from Texas, we could get 10. Not so fast. Let's think this through. What kind of representation, what kind of senators in partisan terms will we get from Houston? I think that's a 50-50 proposition at best.
Yeah.
You agree? Okay, so let's do a partisan tally here. Let's talk about our 10 senators, Democrats and Republicans. So our 10 senators. Let's give one to the Democrats and one to the Republicans out of Houston. All right. In the Dallas-Fort Worth, I'll probably go the same.
Yeah, it's probably 50-50 there as well.
50-50, right? So we got four. If we go to, all right, well, let's go to West Texas here.
I think Republicans would have an advantage
there. We'll get two Republicans there. But if we run it along the border in San Antonio, I think we get two Democrats, right?
Yeah.
All right. And then we go to Central Texas, where Austin kind of dominates, but in the surrounding areas, you get a lot of conservatism, so
it might be like a 60-40 split, but I still think you probably end up with one Republican and one Democrat.
I think you're probably right. So if you guys are out there thinking is naked partisans looking to enhance the power of your political party, it's not clear to me that either side, especially the Republicans, you'd think, wow, in Texas, if you could magnify the power, you get these 10 Republican senators. I don't know. Now, obviously, this is just a thought game. It depends on who actually ran, and there's going to be a lot of changes in the populations in our five different states here over time. But, it's something worth thinking about. So, anyway, thank you for the indulgence. I love the idea of the semicolon, and, we're pointing out elements of the Constitution that are there. They don't get as much attention as the three major branches or the Bill of Rights, but please pay attention to the Constitution. Look at it. There's all of these interesting provisions. And I got to say, grammatically, if you read that Section 3 of Article 4, that is a tortured clause.
Yes, it is.
So, clarity does matter with respect to language, at any rate. Okay, so let's move away from sort of a textual reading of the Constitution. But we're not going too far from the Constitution. Second topic, what do we got? We got a little bit about gambling?
Oh, yes. So on May 14th, the Supreme Court struck down a 1992 federal law that banned commercial sports betting in most states. So again, certain states were allowed to do it, but most states were not. And
I know Nevada was.
Yeah, Nevada could still do it. But it opened the door for legalizing an estimated $150 billion, that's billion with a B, in illegal wagers on professional amateur sports that Americans make every day. Now, the decision overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which prohibited states from authorizing sports gambling. However, New Jersey, it was written, or one of the sponsors was Senator Bill Bradley, who was a Democrat from New Jersey.
Played with the Knicks, Hall of Fame, played at Princeton.
Yeah, went to Princeton. I think he, did he even win a gold medal?
I think he did.
Yeah, won a gold medal.
I think he did. One of the great players of all time, yeah.
And so he said the law was there to safeguard the integrity of sports, because again, there's concerns of point shaving. There's always these point shaving scandals, things of that nature that people are concerned about, so he wanted to prevent that. But the court actually ruled that it was unconstitutional. And Justice Samuel Alito stated in the majority opinion, it is as if federal officers were installed in state legislative chambers and were armed with the authority to stop legislators from voting on any offending proposals. So a more direct affront to state sovereignty is not easy to imagine. So what you have here allowing states to do this, but one of the things that's really important to understand about Supreme Court decisions is the logic that's used to make this to make these decisions. So a lot of times people talk about, well, this is the immediate outcome, states can now legalize gambling. But if you look at the rhetoric, if you look at how it is discussed, this really deals with what the federal government can do in relation to the states. And this has opened up the door for a lot of other challenges that states can make to the federal government, saying what the federal government can and cannot force it to do. And specifically regarding sanctuary cities, where the federal government has tried to force certain cities that want to protect immigrants from ICE, things of that nature. That they are, again, ICE is Immigration Customs Enforcement, not like the stuff on the road. But there is talk about the federal government trying to punish these cities. However, the Supreme Court ruling in many ways limits what the federal government can do or what they can force the states to do. And so it's going to be very important to see how this plays out, because while we think of this as dealing only with gambling, it has large ramifications, or huge ramifications, for understanding the relationship between the federal government and state governments regarding who can dictate what type of action.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly a federalism case, right? So, you know, in this first module that you guys are getting, first set of modules that you're getting, we're talking about the Constitution, we're talking about federalism. And clearly, the fascinating thing, as Professor McDaniel says about this gambling decision, is the Supreme Court said, look, the federal government can't tell the state legislatures, you can't pass legislation on this. This is, you can't do that, right? So, and then it's got this kind of interesting, you know, set of ramifications, because it's gambling and we're all sort of interested in gambling. There's all this potential revenue that's available to the states. But, you know, from our perspective, whatever you think about that, and that's obviously very important, but there's a larger kind of principle involved here, and that's, you know, states' rights and the very limited nature of the federal government as prescribed in the Constitution. All right, so we want to move from, you know, the Constitution. We've talked a little bit about something that's very key to federalism, and we'll sort of end on our third issue today is, you know, we've got some information in this module on civil rights and civil liberties, and this has come up very recently, last week, in the NFL, the National Football League, right, where you all have probably seen this, and if you haven't, let me just give you a little bit of background. Last football season, there was a lot of controversy as a set of players would kneel in advance or during the national anthem. Colin Kaepernick was the most notable, and actually Kaepernick's protests, I think, go back a couple of years. I don't think it was last year. And Kaepernick was protesting, police and law enforcement treatment of African-American individuals. And so he took a knee. Actually, I think at first he did something else.
He sat at first, but then after talking to veterans, he said take a knee.
Took a knee during the national anthem. And the NFL came out and basically said, we don't like this at all. And other players, and Donald Trump talked about it, and other players sort of picking up, as the lines were being drawn, other players began to kneel during the national anthem as well. And the NFL had some declining ratings last year, you know, some people think that's because of the politics of the NFL. Some people think it's just because, you know, things like the red zone or, you know, mobile devices, which allow you to get highlights and not have to sit through an actual. There's all sorts of explanations for that. But the NFL owners decided that the sort of politics and a backlash against players taking stands, not necessarily against the national anthem, but to do these protests, that was hurting them. So they got together and enacted a policy. And the policy, just so I make sure I get it right here, they unanimously approved a new national anthem policy that requires players to stand if they're on the field during the national anthem. You know, they can stay in the locker room if they want and do whatever. But if they come on the field, they are required to stand. If they do not stand during the national anthem while on the field, the team will be fined. Now, you notice a couple of accommodations here. They said, like, well, you can stay in the locker room, but if you come out, you have to stand. They also said that the team will be fined, and the team can elect to pay the fine on behalf of the player, or they can pass it on to the player. So that's their attempted compromise here. However, both the news media and the NFL Players Association said, look, this is a free speech. This is a civil liberties issue. And, in fact, the National Football League player the NFLPA, National Player Association, executive director, their leader is a guy named DeMaurice Smith. He had the following. He tweeted this last Wednesday. History has taught us that both patriotism and protest are like water. If the force is strong enough, it cannot be suppressed. Today, the CEOs of the NFL created a rule that people who hate autocracies should reject. So that's a pretty powerful statement. Subsequent tweet, management has chosen to quash the same freedom of speech, First Amendment issue, that protects someone who wants to salute the flag in an effort to prevent someone who does not wish to do so. The sad irony of this rule is that anyone who wants to express their patriotism is subject to the whim of a person who calls himself an owner. I know that not all of the NFL CEOs are for this, and I know that true American patriots are not cheering today. Right, so that's your reaction from the Players Association, and this really is kind of interesting, right? That we all know, you know, via the First Amendment, we have the right to free speech, but we also know that free speech, like other civil liberties, is subject to limitations, right? You know, and you'll get into this as you do the readings and you study the Constitution. But you're not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater. That's not protected speech because you infringe on the right of others. Right. There's, you know, fighting words doctrine. There's all sorts of limitations on free speech. But this not only involves that, it also involves kind of another question, which is the NFL is a business. At its core, it is a business. And is it do owners have the right to basically tell people you can't protest, or if you protest, you know, you will be fired, you will be fined, you will be subject to these other sorts of, you know, kind of demonstrable penalties. I think most of us would probably say that, you know, yeah, you have the right to protest, but you certainly don't, you know, if you're working for a company, the company, and you are a representative of the company has a right to set the standards for which, by which you say certain things. And so I think we agree with that. But you know, this really is, you know, in a little bit of another region, right? I actually think that this thing probably would have gone away if President Trump hadn't breathed life into it. And I think it probably would have gone away if the owners hadn't reacted the way they did. But again, we're going to be dealing with these issues all semester, right? You have constitutional rights, you have freedoms, you have liberties. But those liberties aren't absolute. And the question as a society and as a government is, how do we navigate that? What's appropriate? What's not? Do the owners have the right to silence the players? I mean, can you blackball Colin Kaepernick because you think he brings negative attention to your organization? Or is that essentially unconstitutional? Right? Are you denying him an opportunity to, you know, seek gainful employment? Because the NFL is a monopoly, right? Colin Kaepernick can't go to an alternative professional football league in the United States because there isn't one. Well, you know, I guess there's arena football, but you know, these things all come into play. So, Professor McDaniel, you got some experience with this. What are your thoughts on it?
It's an interesting topic. I mean, I think one of the key things that people have tried to stress is that the protest is kind of, they've lost control of it. The people who started it were trying to start a conversation about police brutality, about equal treatment under the law. And one of the things you'll see about Colin Kaepernick is that he has evolved during this. At first he was sitting, then I've talked to some veterans like, look, that's just, you can't do that. So take a knee. You know, we understand you're taking a knee, and that is actually respectful in that regard. But then on top of that, people are like, well, what are you doing besides just taking a knee? And you said, okay, fine. So we started teaching classes on civil liberties and civil rights to make sure people are aware of their rights. So he's actually shown commitment to this. But I think what's happened in all of this is people have lost track of why this is happening. And I think this is the same thing that happened in the civil rights movement. This happens with almost all protests. People are mad about the protest as opposed to why they are protesting. And so this really gets lost, and this has come into an issue of being respectful or disrespectful of the flag, which again is somewhat loaded. But then also you were just seeing is this increased amount of patriotism during NFL games, which is relatively new, but the idea of the military being there, and actually the NFL used to charge the military to have these, to do these things. And so the NFL's discussion of protecting the flag and being respectful to the military is problematic because they used to charge the military to show their support. So it's a hot mess in many ways. Furthermore, the authoritarian nature of the NFL, given what's going on with concussions, things of that nature, it's taking a lot of bad hits, and excuse the pun, but it's, you know, it just seems to have PR nightmares. But I think also because it's so popular that it's like, well, you know, we can take any hit and rebound in some way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you said, it's an interesting question, right? I mean, and there's a lot of diversity of opinion, as the NFLPA executive director points out, within the ownership in the NFL. So you've got the ownership structure in San Francisco, which has come out and said, we'll support our players, we will pay the fines if they want to come out in the field and engage in their protests, then we respect that and we will pay the fines that the NFL levies.
And they actually abstain from the vote.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then you've got Jerry Jones, for instance, who's basically said, like, look, you know, this isn't something that's going to fly in Dallas, it's going to hurt our ratings, it's going to, you know, alienate us from our fan base, and, you know, we're not going to have it. I think one of the things Professor McDaniel and I want to emphasize here is that, you know, we have views on a lot of these things, but I think what we want to convey to you all is the complexity and the nuance involved in these sorts of questions, right? I mean, I think most people would clearly agree that, you know, players have First Amendment rights to free speech, even as employees. On the other hand, I think we would also say that, you know, the ownership is trying to protect its product. In fact, they have a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders and to the people who are invested in the team to maximize the profitability of the team. And, you know, so these things all come into play. I think we would acknowledge that there are limits on free speech. The question is, where's the appropriate line? And we don't have any answers, but we want to pose these questions to you guys and get you thinking about them, because you all are going to inherit the country, right? So, all right, with that, anything else? Are we good?
Oh, no, that's all we have for this week.
All right, that's a wrap for our first In the News segment. Good luck, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.